Technorama special interview with Kevin Schindler from the Lowell Observatory, part one of three.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
My child wants to play Spot the Differences, and we're looking for a used blink comparator.
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Hello and welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If you're a new listener, thank you for joining us. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. We appreciate you giving us your time. I am Chuck Tomasi, and with me as always is Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
I feel spacey. Like, space.
You're always spaced out.
The space between my ears. Something like that.
We have a special program today. In May of 2016, we went to the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. The resident historian, Kevin Schindler, was kind enough to give us a whole lot of information about the past, present, and future of the observatory, as well as a little personal insight. It was a lot of fun, and we had a very full day after this interview concluded.
We were also joined by Keith Lane and Ben Raggaton from the TG Geeks. You'll hear their voices throughout the series. They were kind enough to drive us from Phoenix to Flagstaff and back, which is good because Chuck and I just came off a very long work week at a conference our company hosts in Vegas, and we were not exactly up to the task of driving for a couple hours. If you're a listener to both shows, you're going to hear the same material twice, perhaps edited slightly different. So it's kind of like a challenge to each of us.
Spot the differences.
That's right. While Keith brought his brand new recorder, but unfortunately it suffered a technical difficulty and we had to loan him our recording as a backup.
Yeah, so if it sounds like I'm a little tired at the beginning of the interview, that's why. Like I said, we had a lot of stuff to soak up, and we're breaking this up into three parts of roughly 30 minutes each. So if you're jumping in the middle, you may want to go back to our site at chuckchat.com/technorama and listen to the other parts. Otherwise, sit back and enjoy.
Where would you like to begin? You are the historian, so probably the history.
Sure. It was a dark, lonely night back in 1894.
Oh, so, God, for a second there, I thought you were going to tell a completely different person.
When Pluto was formed.
Now, we won't go back that far. That goes back billions of years.
It was a dark and stormy night.
A daddy planet and a mommy planet.
And they love each other very much.
Very much.
Got a baby planet.
We have Pluto.
Well,
just
our beginning,
right.
And you know, we stepped in late in Pluto's life.
Right.
You know, it's 4.5 billion years old. We've only known it for 85 years or so, but the observatory goes back to 1894, and it starts with Percival Lowell, who came from the Lowells of Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, he was one of the blue bloods of the area, and one of the old sayings there, one of the old toasts: "Here's to good old Boston, the home of the bean and the cod, where the Cabots speak only to the Lowells and the Lowells speak only to God." And so that's where they stood in society. If you were a Lowell, you went to Harvard, you inherited wealth, but you were expected to do something with your life. And so if you hear a Lowell name, James Russell Lowell, Amy Lowell, the city of Lowell, it's all the family. Percival was born in 1855, and he was the oldest of several children. His younger brother went on to become president of Harvard for 24 years. One of his sisters married a relative of Theodore Roosevelt's. Another sister married a guy named William Putnam, and mm-hmm. he's the great-grandfather of our current sole trustee. And another sister was Amy Lowell, the cigar-smoking poet who won the Pulitzer Prize right after she died.
Oh, they so, really made a name for themselves.
Yeah, very, very well-to-do family. And so Percival, he studied mathematics at Harvard, always liked astronomy, had his own telescope when he was 15. But he studied mathematics, worked for the family business, and then for 10 years he went overseas. And you know, he was the oldest child, and in general at that time in that sort of society, it was expected that as the oldest he would stay behind and, you know, take on the mantle of leader of the family for the next generation in the community. But he wasn't really interested in that. And so he went overseas while his younger brother, Abbot Lawrence Lowell, stayed in the Boston area, president of Harvard, and was, you know, carried in the family name there. So Percival went to Korea and Japan and spent the better part of 10 years there, and was one of the first Westerners really to immerse himself in Eastern culture, and wrote several books based on his experiences.
What was he doing there?
He was initially went there to just, he was traveling, but he wanted to really spend some time there and learn about the culture and the religions, and then he wrote books based on that. And so, you know, I wouldn't say he was a travel writer, as before there were travel writers probably, but he was a passionate man, and he'd learned about something, and he wanted to learn all he could, and he wanted to be a part of it. So he did that later with astronomy. He did that earlier with the Orient. And his studies really opened the doors to other Westerners, Lafcadio Hearn and others, to really learn about the East. And so Lowell did that for 10 years, wrote several books, came back in the early 1890s to the United States, and now it was time to figure out what he was going to do next. And he decided to go into astronomy because there had been an Italian astronomer named Giovanni Schiaparelli. And in 1870...
Schiaparelli Crater.
He's the one. Schiaparelli was an Italian astronomer. And in 1877, there had been a close approach of Mars to Earth, close like 35 million miles, which is pretty close, relatively. And so during that opposition, what it's called when this gets close, an American astronomer discovered Mars's two moons, Phobos and Deimos. And then the Italian astronomer Schiaparelli saw these really distinct linear features that he called canali.
Mm-hmm. He's the one that started.
Who found the face on Mars?
that comes generations later with the Mariner space, or I think a Mariner, one of the spacecraft. And then we get away from true science with that. But that's a different story. So Schiaparelli discovered these things, and he wasn't the only ones to see them. You know, he was just a scientist, and he observed them, made note of them. But Percival Lowell, in the early 1890s, he found this really interesting because he saw these linear features, and he figured, you know, nothing in nature can be that straight. It must be artificial. It must have been made by some sort of intelligent life. And that's what got Percival interested in building this observatory.
How old was he at the time?
39.
Kind of late in life to all of a sudden switch vocations like
yeah.
that.
Well,
especially
you know,
back then too. I mean, life expectancy wasn't that long anyway, so right. That really is late in life.
Yeah, he spent 8 years in the family business after college, 10 years overseas, and so he really had several different careers. But he got 39 years old, and he had the wherewithal to build the observatory himself. And so he sent a scout out to Arizona Territory. This is 1894.
Not a state yet.
Arizona's not a state till 1912. And so a fellow named Andrew Douglas was an astronomer that Percival Lowell hired to come out here. He carried a telescope, 6-inch diameter telescope that I'll show you. It's sitting out there. And Douglas dragged this thing around Arizona Territory on train, stagecoach, horse and wagon, and went to several different sites, Tombstone, Tempe, Prescott, and set the telescope up in different places to look at the atmospheric conditions. You look at planets and stars at night to see the quality of...
I guess light pollution wasn't an issue by then.
That's one of the, well, it's great you say that, because one of the reasons Lowell came out here was light pollution. Because if we go back to the 1890s...
Gas lamps
were starting to become popular. And if you think about where observatories traditionally were built, it's at the universities, where... astronomers were studied, which were in the middle of town. Yeah, so Lowell realized, he said, you know, he realizes the fashion will be to put telescopes where they may see rather than be seen. And so that's why he sent Douglas out to Arizona. If he had more time, he might have gone to maybe South America because it would have been darker. But he wanted to have access, and he was also in a hurry. He wanted to see an opposition to Mars in 1894. And so said, Douglas, go out there, find me a good site. And so Douglas is traveling around Arizona Territory. In one case, he was on the stagecoach, and the stagecoach drivers had rifles because there were you know, Indians still running around. There were a notorious character called the Apache Kid.
Yeah, this is Apache territory.
Yeah. And so it was a real, you know, real danger. And here's this Eastern dandy you know, carrying this 7-foot-long box, 2 7-foot-long boxes. In fact, when Douglas, he finished in Tempe, and really I should mention that places he went to are kind of interesting. He went to Tombstone, which is just, I don't know, a dozen years removed from the OK Corral, the gunfight OK Corral. Mm-hmm. So Tombstone was past its prime, but still, you know, a very thriving place. In Tempe, Douglas set up the telescope on Tempe Butte, which today is where the Arizona State University football stadium is. Right. Mm-hmm. So luckily, he didn't set the observatory up there. In Tucson, he set the telescope up on what's today a mountain. I think it was called Tumamoc Hill back then. Mm-hmm. So, you know, places that if you go to Tucson or Phoenix, you're familiar with where he set the telescope up. He went to Prescott, finally ended up in Flagstaff. And Flagstaff's conditions were good, but by this time, Percival Lowell was really in a hurry. He didn't have much patience. Douglas would probably still be testing sites.
He was a seed.
Even today.
Yes. Yep. He was detailed.
Ready, aim, never fire.
I'm just a little curious. Why the destination Arizona? I mean, why not, like, go out to California? You know, because, like, or between California and Nevada, we had the Sierra Nevada. It's a really good mountain area there.
Or even just a few miles up the road and put it on top of Mount Humphrey.
Well, in terms of the California, there are several places, like you said, in the Southwest he could have gone. Arizona was, you know, pretty easy to get to by train.
Okay.
Yeah, the railroads up.
It was accessible.
Yeah.
Accessible. Okay.
And I mean, the train, by that time, the Transcontinental Railroad had connected. But still, he made some contacts with people out here, and he could have chosen somewhere else.
All the elements were just right to come.
And another thing are exactly what you said, the elements, the weather elements, you know, the conditions here, it's a desert environment. And so, and there's also places of high elevation here. The higher the elevation, the less atmosphere you have to live through.
But there's higher elevation.
Well, that's a good thought. In fact, at one point, they did testing up on the San Francisco peaks. So we're here in Flagstaff. In downtown Flagstaff, the elevation is about 6,900 feet. Mm-hmm. Up, we're on a mesa just less than a mile from Flagstaff. So up here, it's about 7,200 feet. We're a few hundred feet higher. But through the years, the observatory actually had a field station up on the San Francisco peaks at 11,500 feet.
Wow.
The peaks go up to 12,000+. But they did have a field station up there. There used to be a toll road that went up into the San Francisco peaks. And so they drove up there and then got telescopes up to the top of one of the peaks. But the conditions up there was really windy, and getting up there wasn't easy. And they realized in this particular case, getting higher didn't really add much benefit. Yeah. No, that's not always the case. You know, you go to Hawaii and you have telescopes at 14,000 feet, whatever it is.
And they can also, they can build buildings that can house the equipment without any adverse effects from the weather elements.
Right.
Like, so I can see back at that time, you need to have some kind of a compromise.
Right.
Something that will give you the benefits of the elevation, but at the same time, without any of the negative impact.
And the San Francisco peaks, you know, when Lowell first got here, There was no road up there. That road wasn't built till the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And so they took horse and buggy and did some, you know, small expeditions up there. But it wasn't, you know, they would have had to build a road to get up there if they were going to be there regularly.
Practicality
so,
was
yeah. part of it. And so Flagstaff, at this time, 1894, you know, we're less than a mile from downtown in the train station. There's, I don't know, 1,000 people in Flagstaff at the time, so it's not very big. There's no electricity here yet. And so being right next to the town of Flagstaff wasn't so bad because there was no light pollution. Yeah. It was easy to get to.
Well, fast forward to today. Is this still good conditions?
Let me touch on something else, and I'll go into that. It's really kind of fascinating when you think about Lowell Observatory. When they came here, Flagstaff wasn't necessarily one of the original targets of the site survey. But Douglas kept saying, oh, there's one more place I want to try. I've talked to these guys. So he came up here. And at the time, Flagstaff's nickname was the Skylight City because of the brilliance of the stars. So there was the Skylight Brewing Company, the Skylight Band, all these little community things. And ironically, the observatory was established, and somewhere along the way, that nickname of Skylight City kind of disappeared, even though now we have astronomers who came here because of the brilliance of the stars. But fast forward to decades later, in the 1950s, Flagstaff was growing. Electricity got here in early 1900s, something like that. Got up here at the observatory probably around 1905 or so. And, you know, you get cars, you get light pollution. By the 1950s, this was becoming kind of an issue for the observatory. So they did two things. One was to establish another site 12 miles outside of town, away from the city lights. And the other is that Lowell astronomers worked with the city leaders to establish a light ordinance to limit certain type of lighting. This was the first light ordinance in the world to address lighting.
What types of
strong
light?
It was
against
back
sodium
then,
lights.
Back then, it was just search. It was, I think they called it spotlights.
Okay.
And it was real. It was real limited, but it was the first in the world to have some sort of regulation. And so then, that's the 1950s. You fast forward again several decades, and the 1990s, Flagstaff has low pressure sodium lights, and largely because of the astronomy, but also because this community is, it's a, you know, there's so much science here. At one time, Flagstaff supposedly had more astronomers per capita than anywhere else in the world, making us nerd central.
Yeah.
And so there's so much science here because if you look at the resources, the Grand Canyon, there's geology, paleontology, botany, you know, dark skies, all these resources that are unique here. Yeah.
Cryptozoology.
There's that too. And so you know, this is really a center for scientific research, not just astronomy, but others. So this community really has an appreciation, not just as scientists, but as people who appreciate natural resources, that we should preserve them. And so this community, as a community, has really worked hard to maintain dark skies and worked with businesses to try to figure
outstanding.
Out... Outstanding. You know,
aim the lights away from the observatory.
And so in 2001, Flagstaff was named the world's first international dark sky city. And so, so while dark skies is a big part of who we are, you know, even though that's the case, I mean, we do have car lights and all the other lights. So in the 1950s, we had a dark sky site put up 12 miles outside of town, a place called Anderson Mesa, right across from Lake Mary, one of the water supplies.
And we saw the picture of that in the big poster. In the
And then in the 90s, our astronomers started saying, you know, our big telescopes aren't big enough anymore. We need to build the latest big telescope, which ultimately became the Discovery Channel Telescope, which is the fifth largest telescope in the continental U.S. It's 14 feet across, a single piece of glass, feet across. And so they decided to build that, in astronomy it does.
Bigger the better.
Yeah. So in that case, by this time, 1990s, 2000s, Flagstaff had grown so much that while our Anderson Mesa dark sky site is still excellent, it's not quite good enough. If you're going to build a 14 diameter telescope, find an even better site. So another 30 miles down the road, by a little place called Happy Jack, is where that telescope is. And so, how's that for a long answer to your question?
This is Bob. Before, Bob relied on the internet to enhance his geek status. After using Technorama for natural geek enhancement, Bob is rolling his 20-sided die, reciting Holy Grail lines, and answering Star Trek trivia with the best of them. And he has a happy missus at the home, too. Technorama for natural geek enhancement. Only available at chuckchat.com.
My name's Adam Stelzner. I'm an engineer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and I think Technorama just might be the right kind of crazy.
So back to 1894.
And then the next month. So the observatory founded partly because of dark skies. Percival Lowell was one of the early people to realize this. And through the years, he studied Mars, and that's one of the things that Lowell's remembered for. Percival Lowell and the observatory is his early controversial studies of Mars. And I think, you know, Lowell is such a unique place. There are a lot of great observatories and science centers that have history. There are a lot that have research. There are a lot that do outreach. But we have all three. We, you know, our mission is to do research and to share it with the public. And we've been doing it long enough that we have this great history. And but our history is more than just the discoveries and this is what it means. It's the this personality the place has. This guy, Percival Lowell, who thought there was life on Mars, who really influenced not only development of science, but science fiction.
Mm-hmm. Drat this science.
Yes.
So nutty and complex.
I heard Marvin somewhere here. Wait a minute. I think I have a tie with Marvin the Martian, actually.
Perfect.
But Lowell, he, you know, he built his theories were controversial. And so a lot of scientists said, you're crazy. At a certain point, by 1907 or so, a lot of scientists said, okay, these canals aren't there. They're not real features. But what's interesting is that they still hedged their bets. Not until spacecraft started getting to Mars did canals stop showing up on maps. There's a map from the 1960s by National Geographic still shows the canals.
I remember.
So even
books
yeah,
absolutely.
Even though scientists in general said no, there are no canals there, they're still kind of hedging their bets. And I think, you know, hoping that maybe
one in a million
there's something there.
There is a chance.
Yeah,
abandoned canals maybe.
And so Lowell had this influence that, you know, inspired scientists to either prove or disprove these theories. But then, you know, he built this public consciousness of life out there. Because Lowell was he wasn't a trained scientist, although he was a very intelligent person. He went to school for mathematics. Mm-hmm. He didn't go to school for astronomy, but he learned it. But he not only did the research, but he got into the public. He was a great speaker, a compelling speaker, and kind of the Carl Sagan of his time in a lot of ways, or the Neil deGrasse Tyson of his time,
wow.
Where he gave public talks, standing room only. He was in the newspaper all the time. If there was any talk about life on Mars, Percival Lowell. And so he was this you know, really compelling character that, you know, he just built this awareness of this life on Mars thing. So writers like H.G. Wells and Edgar Rice Burroughs, even if they didn't specifically cite Lowell, he built this consciousness that there's life on Mars. So that's what they wrote about. I mean, you don't read about Plutonians attacking Earth or Saturnians. It's usually Martians. That goes back to Percival Lowell.
Yeah.
So we have him to thank for all those cheeseball movies. And yeah, speaking of cheeseball movies.
It's his fault.
And you know, what's interesting about Lowell, I think, is, again, you know, he did a lot of things. He studied Mars. He started this observatory. He started searching for a theoretical ninth planet that he called Planet X. And that led to the discovery of Pluto. The planet he was looking for actually doesn't exist, but they happened to find Pluto. He was looking for a planet that was really big that could pull or perturb Uranus and Neptune, their orbits.
Mm-hmm.
Later astronomers realized that such a planet actually wouldn't exist. But in Lowell's time, astronomers believed the planets were so big, and if they're so big, they couldn't account for some of its motion, so there must be another planet out there. So Lowell spent years mathematically calculating where this thing should be, and then he died. And then a few years later astronomers here at Lowell started looking again and found this planet that they called Pluto, right where Lowell thought a planet should be. But lo and behold, Pluto is not nearly big enough to tug on Uranus and Neptune. So, and then Lowell had, you know, he developed this idea of planetology that, you know, if you think, you know, Charles Darwin came up with theory of evolution in 1859.
Mm-hmm.
And for the ensuing decades, people in all fields jumped on this. And to where you had somebody like Herbert Spencer, who talked about, he went beyond biological evolution, just the evolution of the universe. And Percival Lowell picked up on this idea that, and he developed the idea he called planetology, where the planets go through a state of evolution. Young planets are formed, they're these big balls of gas, and they're still very young, like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune.
Mm-hmm.
As time, they condense. A lot of that outer atmosphere blows off, but you still have an atmosphere. And that's middle age, and that's Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And Mars has an atmosphere, and Venus. And then eventually, the atmosphere all blows off, and you're left with this dead, rocky planet, and you have Mercury.
Right.
So it's kind of a natural, it seemed to make sense. On middle age planets, You have Earth with an atmosphere, and we have life here. Mars had an atmosphere, so it's in the right stage of evolution. There must be life there.
Yeah.
And then when Lowell started studying Mars and these canals, the canals were proof of that life to him. And so one of his astronomers that came on board was V.M. Slipher, Vesto Melvin Slipher. And Lowell wanted him to study these really fuzzy blobs in space. They were called spiral nebulae at the time. And some astronomers, like Percival Lowell, thought they were protoplanetary systems.
Mm.
Like, this is how...
See how that, yeah.
And so he got V.M. Slipher to get a spectrograph, attach it to our 24-inch telescope. And with a spectrograph, you get spectra. So right. You collect light from a star or planet. And using that spectra, you can identify what that star light is made of.
Correct. Yeah, various elements.
Right. And you can also tell, based on the Doppler shift, if those objects are moving away from you or towards
right.
you. And so Lowell wanted Slipher to study these things and look at the composition and see if they matched up with the composition of Uranus and Neptune and Jupiter and Saturn. And if so, then maybe that connects the tie that these are protoplanetary systems. They have the same composition as planets. Well, turns out they don't have the same composition.
Denied.
But in doing this, Slipher, it's remarkable what he did. He took exposures, made these photographic glass plates.
Mm-hmm.
Some exposures exceeding 40 hours.
Wow.
And so he would set up at night and have this... A glass plate is like a piece of film. That's how you take the picture mm-hmm. in the old days. And he would set the telescope up on, say, the Andromeda Nebula, as it was called.
Right.
And he would... And the telescope would track all night, and he'd have to be looking through a little guide scale telescope to make sure it's tracking accurately. He would do that for, I don't know, 6 hours maybe, until the object got too low in the sky for the telescope or the sun came up or whatever. Close the shutter, next night, move the telescope, set it up as it's coming up, and track for the whole night again. Nobody had ever done this. They had done spectra of stars for a few hours, but nothing like this.
Over multiple nights.
Yeah.
I have a hard time getting a... selfie that's not
right. Yeah. Well, remember we talked about on our show not too long ago about they found some glass plates which actually had evidence of planets, like, and nobody realized until just now, and the plates were like over 100 years old.
Yeah, they were analyzing the light pattern. I said, well, if we analyze it today, it's there's evidence
that,
of a planet.
Was that the affecting... one that of the new planet X?
I think so.
No, this is a planet around another star.
Ah, okay.
So the extra solar planet.
Yeah, when you mentioned the glass plates, it made me think about that. They found those glass plates in somebody's basement, I think.
Yeah.
And then they realized, oh, this was actually evidence.
It almost looks more like a sound wave.
Right.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because, you know, if the pictures are accurate enough, you know, if you like here at the observatory, they start looking for Percival's planet X in 1905. He dies in 1916. 1929, they recommence the search with a different telescope. Discover Pluto here in 1930.
Clytemba.
And then for the next 14 years, Clytemba continued photographing the sky. And so he photographed the majority of the sky you can see from the Northern Hemisphere. And then a couple decades later, they re-photograph the same area of the sky, and then they compare the stars and see how they change with time. Mm. It's called the proper motion, and see how their positions change. But those are great photographic records of the sky. You discover an asteroid, for instance, you can go back to those plates, and if you can find it, then you can use that to help track its orbit. So when Tamba discovered Pluto in 1930, they went back on these old photographic plates taken here, and on a set taken in 1915, they found Pluto.
Wow.
And so that was taken 15 years earlier, and that helped them determine the orbit of Pluto. Because if you just take it on one day, how do you know how it's moving? You
too
can't
much
determine
distance.
The orbit. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, any movement will be negligible.
Exactly. So the more you can, the more spread out over the years you can see this thing, the better you can.
I assume they had to take account for parallax. I mean, if you're going to do this in June versus December, it's going to visually appear in a different part of the sky, so you'd have to do
comparisons. Yeah, you know, when we talk about it, you really simplify it. Oh, they took some pictures, but it is really, you know, it's very exact.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, just like with V.M. Slipher, with the spectra of those distant objects, which we know today as galaxies, because he looked at these things, he didn't find a connection between the planets and these spiral nebulae. But what he did find was, in general, these things were cruising away from us, just speeding away.
So it wasn't Hubble?
Slipher was the first person to realize that these things were moving. Some were moving towards us.
Okay.
But most were moving at incredible speed, some in excess of 900 times the speed of sound away from us. That was unheard of. Nobody, they didn't know what to make of it at the time. Slipher observed several of these objects, which again we know today as galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1914 at a science meeting in Chicago, or up in Illinois, Evanston, he presented these discoveries of these observations, and that in general these things were moving so far away. And scientists gave him a standing ovation. This is a professional science meeting. That doesn't happen usually. And what they realized is they didn't know what to make of this yet, but what this told them was these objects are moving so fast away from us. If the universe were only 100 years old, multiply 100 times how fast these things are moving, mm-hmm. that tells us the universe is much larger than we ever thought.
Age.
And about what time was this?
This is starting in 1912.
Okay, I know that a popular theory that existed in a lot of higher education was the steady state theory.
Right.
I think even Einstein subscribed to the steady state.
Exactly. And it wasn't until years later that he started thinking about the idea of the universe expanding.
Yeah.
And that's where this was the first evidence that the universe was expanding. And then Hubble came along, and Hubble overlapped with Slipher. He was younger than Slipher. Slipher gave these presentations in 1912, and by that time Slipher was, let's see, in his 20s, early 30s maybe. And Hubble was a student, I think, mm-hmm. still up at the University of Chicago. But he attended that meeting. And so they corresponded through the years.
There we go.
But Hubble, by the 1920s, was out at Mount Wilson Observatory in California. And he used these findings of Slipher with his own findings that allowed him, using Cepheid variables, to determine distances of different objects. He put Hubble put it all together. He was a theorist. Okay. He put it all together and came up with the theory of the expanding universe. So Slipher made those first detections that these things are speeding away. Hubble's the one that put this all together and realized this is what it means. And so it's, you know, the old saying that has been attributed to Newton and probably many others, you know, if I see further, it's because I stand on the shoulders of giants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Slipher was one of those early giants. There are some others who made fundamental discoveries, and then Hubble came along and
put the pieces
synthesized
together.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so what is neat about Lowell, you know, the Mars, life on Mars, he was wrong. There's no intelligent life there. The Planet X, there was no Planet X. They happened to find a planet there. These spiral nebulae, are they actually planets in the formation? No. But look what came out of all this research.
Mm-hmm.
They discovered Pluto, the first evidence of the expanding universe. And Mars, all the drama about Mars, the excitement in both science and non-science circles. And so, you know, you look back at a lot of scientists and think what their contributions were. And while you could say that one hand Lowell was incorrect about some of those things, the fact that he just put his money where his mouth was and made these things happen.
Well, he certainly shaped pop culture.
And he did. He shaped pop culture. He shaped science. And he's one of those guys that, first of all, in science, how many discoveries were made not because it was intended, but because they found something there.
Right.
So it shouldn't devalue the fact that, okay, he was wrong about this, but they still made this great discovery.
Yeah,
the fact that he was studying. But the other, I think the other thing is that you guys know Stephen Jay Gould. He's not alive anymore, but he was an evolutionary paleontologist. He wrote for Natural History Magazine for years.
Oh, sure. Okay.
And he subscribed to what he called contingency. If you replayed life and one little thing changed, how everything would change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he used as an example, It's a Wonderful Life, you know, Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Which leads us to the multiverse.
Yeah. And you weren't born. What was his name in there?
George.
Yeah, George Bailey. Okay, you've not been born. And then they replay his life, and you know the guys that his brother saved on the transport all die. And so I've been thinking about this with Percival Lowell, and there are a lot of scientists of the old days that they did a lot of great work that contributed. But with Percival Lowell, if you replayed it, and if he didn't found this observatory, Douglas wouldn't have come out here, so wouldn't have founded Stewart Observatory in Tucson. He wouldn't have founded the science of dendrochronology, tree ring dating. Somebody might have figured that out eventually. Pluto probably wouldn't have been discovered till the 1990s, and never wouldn't have been called a planet. So we wouldn't have all this controversy of ninth planet. If you replay it, and Lowell didn't found this observatory and go to astronomy, the future would have changed so much
right. In
pop culture, in science. And certainly in science, there are a lot of astronomers that were turned off by Lowell's studies. And so they decide, I'm done with the solar system. I'm going to go. And it was also at a time when astrophysics was developing. And so there was an idea that, okay, we know all there is to know about the planets. Let's start going out further.
Yeah, so they thought.
And so that was happening. But also some were kind of turned off by Lowell and his life on Mars stuff. So they just stopped studying planets as much.
Well, as we have a DVD talking about theoretical physics, and this one lady says, well, she spouts some theory and says they think we're crackpots and bananas in her English accent. But, I mean, if he was considered a crackpot, but look at his contribution to what other people have picked up
where
he left off.
And
a lot of what he found is did have some merit.
Oh, yeah, he was an excellent observer. There's no question.
Yeah. And then all the things that they did, send this guy to do this mapping and all that kind of stuff.
Did his mathematics background come into play during astronomy years?
Yep. In fact, his professor was at Harvard was Benjamin Pierce, who was then a noted mathematician. And he called Lowell one of the best, if not the best, students he ever had. And that was Lowell's specialty. So when he started looking into things like searching for another planet, he was doing it both observationally, looking through a telescope, but mathematically, based on the irregular movements of Uranus and Neptune,
right. Where
and how big would another planet have to be?
And
that's pretty complicated stuff.
Very mathematical, and I'm sure he kept in intricate notes.
So even though some of his conclusions may have been considered to be a little bit crackpot, there was actual some sort of science that
right. Went
into the process of the discovery.
And some of his theories were based on, he was a very intelligent person, but they were based on assumptions that were just incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
The size of the planets, we didn't know until spacecraft got out there, in some cases, to get a real actual mass of some of the planets. This is still, early astronomy. Right. And it's just like, that he lived in a time when the Earth was
still.
I don't know if it was a million years old yet.
Yeah.
In the minds of science,
yeah.
I'm not quite sure. It was maybe hundreds of thousands. Maybe it was in the millions of years old. It certainly wasn't billions of years old.
Right.
Well,
if you look back and say,
it's all the religious people that it's older than 4,000 years and that whole thing.
Yeah. And the Earth is round.
Of course, it's round.
Like a plate.
Right.
I disagree. Like a plate.
Once again, we really appreciate Kevin Schindler from the Lowell Observatory for giving us his time out of his busy schedule. Elena Lane for coordinating the interview, and the entire Lowell staff for their generosity, knowledge, and sometimes patience for putting up with our antics, that's for sure. Thanks to Ben and Keith from the TG Geeks. You can find their podcast at tggeeks.com. You can also find our show at chuckchat.com/technorama, along with links to our other information. Be sure to subscribe and so you don't miss other parts of the interview, because there are three other specials we have coming up in our regular weekly show that is also broadcast live on YouTube.
Special thanks to our Patreon patrons for making specials like this possible. You can support this show by going to patreon.com/technoramapodcast. For as little as $1 a show, you'll get special after show topics that nobody else in the whole world gets to hear.
And speaking of support, we encourage you to go support the Lowell Observatory through July of 2016, the one-year anniversary from the New Horizons flyby. They are raising funds to restore the Pluto telescope, yes, the telescope that they used to discover the planet all those years ago. It is still there and needs some TLC, so go to lowell.edu to find out how you can contribute.
Until next time, tell a friend about Technorama, and Craig is always ready with that binary high five. Go for it!
101.